You're listening to North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. The date of this issue is July 22nd, 2019. The cover story, The Strong Survive. On the cusp of history, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu tests the limits of power. Article by Brian Bennett. There is an interview with Benjamin Netanyahu in the middle of that article, and we will go right to that interview to make sure that we're able to include it. The interview with Benjamin Netanyahu. Time says the Prime Minister spoke to Time's Brian Bennett and Joseph Hinks on June 25th in Jerusalem. The following excerpts from the conversation have been condensed and edited. First question. You are on track to surpass David Ben-Gurion as Israel's longest-serving prime minister. How does Netanyahu's Israel look different from Ben-Gurion's? Answer. Where I've tried to contribute to the country, and I think it's changed dramatically, is in the development of Israel as a global technological power. Question. What are the factors that contributed to that shift? Answer. Turning Israel into a free market economy, I think, was the second critical factor that made Israel the rising power that it is among the countries. The first was the high-intensity use of our most gifted men and women in our military for intelligence purposes. Question. What can be done to help the millions of people who live in the occupied territories who haven't benefited from that rise? Answer. Well, I'd separate Gaza from the West Bank, from Judea and Samaria, because there the Palestinian economy is on much better footing. Gaza is basically controlled by Hamas, which is a militant Islamic organization that really doesn't allow any kind of real development to take place because they take all the money that comes in from international support, and there's quite a bit of it, and they put it into terror tunnels, into a terror machine, because militarily, we are in charge of the West Bank. There's no siphoning off of money for that purpose. I'd like to see more and more and more investments in the private sector go to the Palestinian areas for joint Israeli-Palestinian efforts. I think what Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt have embarked in Moran could be tremendously beneficial to the Palestinians. Question. But the Palestinian officials wouldn't even show up in Bahrain for that. Answer. Let the markets do their thing, because if we can get this ball rolling, then I think it would enhance Palestinian lives, and I think it will also enhance peace. It's not a substitute for political solutions, but it sure makes it a lot easier. Question. Is the Trump plan going to propose an annexation of settlements? Answer. Well, I think we have to leave it to the plan as it comes out. Question. Is there something you are looking for in that plan? Answer. I think everybody recognizes that under any realistic peace proposal, there are areas in Judea and Samaria that have already become basically part of Israel already. It's a fact. Half of Jerusalem is beyond the proverbial green line, the 67 separation. Does anyone believe that we'll tear up half of Jerusalem? Question. Many say, talking more and more steps off the table. Repeat the question. Many say taking more and more steps off the table has driven the Palestinians away from the peace process. Answer. we should be able to get in the room and begin to discuss it. They refuse to enter the room. Question. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak still insists that Mahmoud Abbas is the man to make peace. Is that not the case? Answer. Let's see, you know. Let's see. Question. First-year members of Congress have been critical of Israel. Representative Ilhan Omar said that Israel was an apartheid regime. What is your response? Answer. I think it's nonsense. Question. When you look at the economic data, Israeli Arabs have not benefited as much as other citizens of Israel from the economic boom. Answer. Well, I've been working hard to change that. If you actually go beyond all these stereotypes and you look at what we are doing, what my government has done is to take 15 billion shekels, parenthetically $4.2 billion, that's a lot of money in Israel, and put it into a multi-year plan that has already had a measurable effect for improving the lives and especially the infrastructure in the Arab sector. Question. You've been a polarizing figure among American Jews. Do you feel like you've played a role in increasing the divide between U.S. and Israeli Jews? Answer. I don't think I've been a polarizing figure at all. I'm often described in some circles the way you describe, but it's not true. It doesn't reflect my basic tendency. I want every Jew to feel at home in Israel. Question. Has the Trump administration's policy on Iran made Israel more unsafe? Answer. The answer categorically is no. What has challenged Israel's security is Iran's goal, one, to have nuclear weapons, which they intend to use to annihilate Israel, and second, their attempts to bring their army or pieces of their army into Syria, right in Israel's backyard. Question. If Iran starts stockpiling nuclear materials beyond agreed limits, what kind of action are you willing to take? Answer. We'll take whatever action is necessary to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Question. Does that include an open strike on Iranian nuclear facilities? Answer. Whatever action is necessary will be taken. Question. Are those facilities too far underground to be impacted by strikes? Answer. Let's consider what an intelligent journalist like you would consider an intelligent response to that. If I say yes, or if I say no. I think neither one is satisfactory. So I'm just going to say, we'll take whatever action is needed. Question. Have the corruption investigations weakened you politically? Answer. I don't think so. I think it actually works the other way around because people just don't buy it. They think it's a concoction, and I know it's a concoction because there's nothing there. But people by and large, my supporters, have been, if anything, energized by it. Final question. What has been the key to your political survival? Answer. I don't look at my survival. I look at the survival of the country, its durability, its future. Entire interview with Benjamin Netanyahu. This is part of a cover story. And time permitting, we will come back to the actual story itself. But going now to the beginning of the magazine, we come to the page called For the Record, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing or a major caption or headline in bold or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page, is a story illustrated by a quotation from Filippo Magnini, Italian Olympic swimmer on saving a man from drowning in Sardinia on July 7th. The quotation from Italian Olympic swimmer Filippo Magnini, quote, "I did what I had to do," unquote. In the center right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 73. Caption explains, number of years the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, 94, has been married to his wife, Rosalind, 91, as of their July 7th anniversary. Also illustrating that particular item is a line drawing of Jimmy Carter handing red roses to Rosalind Carter. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Weiner, Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner, files for divorce from architect Linda Brettler. Under Good Week, Wieners, Joey Chestnut, 8-71, to win the 2019 Nathan's Famous International Hot Dog Eating Contest. 71 hot dogs. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $12,666,181,704. Caption explains, amount that Joaquin Guzman Loera, known as El Chapo, earned selling drugs, according to a forfeiture document filed by prosecutors who want the money back ahead of his July 17th sentencing at a federal court in Brooklyn. In the left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Michelle Obama, former First Lady, on what she learned on the book tour for her memoir, Becoming, on July 6th at the Essence Festival in New Orleans. And the quotation from former First Lady Michelle Obama, quote, people are really hungry for stories, hungry for stories of people who look and feel like them, unquote. In the upper left corner of the page, as a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 1 in 4, caption explains, approximate ratio of Americans who say they don't plan to ever retire, according to a poll published on July 7th, 1 in 4. Running along the top of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in red from Naomi Osaka, tennis player and 2018 U.S. Open winner, in a text message to Serena Williams, who was penalized for lashing out at a referee when they played each other in the tournament final. The quotation from tennis player Naomi Osaka, quote, people can misunderstand anger for strength, unquote. Caption goes on to say, Williams shared the note in a July 9th personal essay in Harper's Bazaar. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Kim Darroch, UK ambassador to the US, in a 2017 email, one of many critical emails the diplomat sent about Trump, which were leaked to the Daily Mail and published on July 7th. And the quotation from UK Ambassador Kim Darroch, quote, for a man who has risen to the highest office on the planet, President Trump radiates insecurity, unquote. Caption goes on to say, Darroch resigned 3 days later. In the upper center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from William Barr, U.S. Attorney General, saying July 8th that he believes there's still a legal way to put a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, even after the highest court rejected the administration's rationale for including it. The quotation from Attorney General William Barr in black and all caps, quote, "The Supreme Court decision was wrong," unquote. That was the entire content of the For the Record page. On the facing page is the beginning of the major section, the brief. And the major section opening the brief is opener. The subsection here is courts, where the headline is, "What revived the case against Jeffrey Epstein?" by Katie Riley. The charges facing financier Jeffrey Epstein involve child sex trafficking. But when prosecutors presented the details, this one stood out. The girls he's accused of sexually abusing are no longer children. Quote, "While the charged conduct is from a number of years ago, it is still profoundly important to the many alleged victims, now young women," unquote, Jeffrey Berman, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, said at a press conference on July 8th, quote, "They deserve their day in court, and we are proud to be standing up for them by bringing this indictment," unquote. Epstein, 66, is accused of exploiting dozens of girls as young as 14 in his homes in Manhattan and Palm Beach, Florida, enticing them with cash and recruiting them to give him, quote, massages, unquote, that turned sexual. The new charges against him, parenthetically sex trafficking and sex trafficking conspiracy, to which he pleaded not guilty, relate to incidences that allegedly took place from 2002 to 2005. The intervening years don't mean it's too late for Epstein to face his day in court. No statute of limitations applies. The 2006 law that eliminated the federal statute of limitations for child sex trafficking applies to incidents that occurred as early as 2001. And prosecutors in New York say they aren't bound by a 2008 plea deal Epstein reached with federal prosecutors in Florida after he was accused there of abusing dozens of girls. Still, the new charges were quickly followed by questions about how prosecutors treated Epstein in the past and why it took so long to meaningfully pursue allegations that were an open secret. Berman declined to comment specifically on what led his office to act now, but said prosecutors were, quote, "assisted by some excellent investigative journalism," unquote, an apparent reference to a November 2018 Miami Herald series that found about 80 young women who said they were sexually abused by Epstein from 2001 to 2006. And the Herald series didn't emerge in a vacuum. Victims' advocates and legal experts say the Me Too movement played a key role in changing the way such cases are handled. The shift in perspective was not only in the courthouse. In December, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse asked the Justice Department to investigate Epstein's plea deal, writing that the, quote, "secret sweetheart deal for this child rapist should enrage moms and dads everywhere," unquote. And in the wake of the new charges, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats called for the resignation of Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, who in 2008 was the U.S. attorney in Miami who oversaw Epstein's plea deal. As Acosta defended the agreement at a July 10th press conference, he noted that, quote, "we live in a very different world," unquote, now. Quote, "It's not that the girls didn't come forward years ago. the victims did come forward years ago, unquote, says Jane Manning, a former New York City sex crimes prosecutor, who was now an attorney for rape survivors. Quote, what's making a difference now is the brave survivors who have spoken out as part of the Me Too movement and the advocates and journalists who have stood with them, unquote. Calls to bring powerful men to justice for previous crimes have echoed across the past 2 years. And old sex abuse claims have resulted in some of the Me Too era's biggest cases. In what was seen as the first major trial of a nascent movement, a jury last year found comedian Bill Cosby guilty of aggravated indecent assault on the basis of accusations dating from 2004. The conviction followed years of allegations from numerous women and a previous prosecutor's decision not to pursue charges. In February, after nearly two decades facing sexual misconduct claims, singer R. Kelly was indicted on charges of aggravated criminal sexual abuse for events said to have taken place from 1998 to 2010. Producer Harvey Weinstein was indicted last year on Rape and Criminal Sex Act charges based on alleged incidents from 2004, 2006, and 2013. Cosby, who denies the accusations, has appealed. Both Kelly and Weinstein pleaded not guilty. Quote, this is probably a better time to bring a case than in 2007 or 2008, given that there are more men being held to accountability, unquote, says Margot Kaplan, who teaches courses on criminal law and sex crimes at Rutgers Law School. Quote, I think that now that we're turning our attention and investigating these cases in the appropriate way, we're uncovering evidence that is so shockingly consistent that we can't ignore it, unquote, echoes Colby Bruno, senior legal counsel at the Victim Rights Law Center. Quote, and I think that's what the Me Too movement did, unquote. Already, the Epstein case has shown how that attention encourages speaking up. 2 days after Berman asked anyone else who might have been a victim to come forward, a new accuser said on NBC's Today Show that Epstein, quote, forcefully raped her in 2002. For clarity, I will repeat that with apologies. On NBC's Today Show, said that Epstein, quote, forcefully raped, unquote, her in 2002. When she was 15, Epstein did not immediately respond to the new allegation. But not every case gets the kind of attention, other observers point out. A few revisited cases, they say, isn't yet a sign of lasting progress, especially for the thousands of abuse victims who make allegations against perpetrators who are not famous. Quote, one or two high-profile cases, unquote, Kaplan says, quote, does not make a sea change, unquote. Entire article written by Katie Riley. On the facing page, the subsection is The Bulletin, where the headline is, a compromise candidate is set to become the first female chief of the EU, article by Julia Webster, who writes, a loyal ally of German Chancellor Angela Merkel emerged on July 2nd as the surprise candidate to become European Commission President, one of the most powerful positions in Europe. Ursula von der Leyen, Germany's defense minister, was nominated by France's Emmanuel Macron after negotiations among EU leaders reached an impasse. for the confirmation vote by the EU Parliament set for July 16th, von der Leyen is set to shape the Union's political agenda for the next 5 years. And here, Julia Webster lists three categories. First category, social reformer. As the daughter of a former European commissioner, von der Leyen embodies the European project. She was born and raised in Brussels and speaks fluent French and English. She entered politics in her 40s after a career as a gynecologist and has since become the longest-serving member of Merkel's cabinet. A mother of seven, she has been vocal about gender parity in Germany and implemented parental leave for fathers as Labor and Social Affairs Minister. Second category, firm federalist. If von der Leyen is confirmed, she will become the first female leader of the European Union's executive branch, heading a group of 28 commissioners. The 60-year-old favors greater integration of the bloc. She has said she wants her grandchildren to grow in a, quoted, United States of Europe, unquote, and has called for the establishment of a European army. Final category, division sign. Not everyone is happy with her nomination. Europe's socialist parties believed their candidate, Franz Timmermans, to be the favorite. The newly influential Green Party says von der Leyen is not progressive enough on climate change. She has also been criticized by opposition politicians in Germany. Former European Parliament Speaker Martin Schulz calls her, quote, the weakest minister in the government, unquote. At the helm of a fractious EU, increasingly divergent on migrant policies, economic reforms, and more, she can expect more polarized opinions to come. Entire article written by Julia Webster. On this page, in the margin, is the sidebar feature, News Ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, ICE used facial recognition on licenses. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement used facial recognition tech to examine millions of licenses, driver's licenses, millions of individuals' driver's licenses, without their knowledge or approval from Congress or state legislatures, the Washington Post revealed July 7th. DMV databases in at least three states were accessed for scans. Second item in the middle. Domestic violence draws Paris protest. Hundreds of demonstrators turned out in the streets of Paris on July 6th, to demand action against increasing domestic violence in France. The country's interior ministry said 130 women there were killed by their partners in 2017, which was up from 123 in 2016. 123 women killed in 2016. 130 women were killed by their partners in 2017. Final item. 4th of July parade saps D.C. budget. President Trump's 4th of July celebration cost the Washington, D.C. government $1.7 million, bankrupting a fund dedicated to providing security and protecting the Capitol from terrorist threats. Democratic D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser wrote to Trump July 9th, requesting that the White House commit to reimbursing the fund for the costs. Moving now to the milestones page. lead item under Dodd. Ross Perot, The Independent. Observance by Larry King. Time notes. King is the host of Hulu's Larry King Now and Politicking with Larry King. Larry King writes, I once asked Ross Perot, who died July 9th at 89, to tell me the secret of his success. He said that he sells umbrellas when it's raining. He knew there was a right place and a right time to take advantage of an opportunity, and boy, did he ever. I'll never forget the day he came on Larry King Live in 1992 to talk about President George H.W. Bush's economic policies. As he was a wildly successful businessman, a lot of people were pushing him to run for Bush's job himself. When he told me he wasn't suited for it, something in me didn't believe him. So I asked again later. Still, no. Toward the end of the interview, I asked a third time. This time he looked at me and said, quote, If I can get on the ballot in all 50 states, I'll do it, unquote. We made history that night. His campaign began on cable television. So, though Perot lost the election, he changed politics. Here's this little man who, let's face it, didn't have a typical presidential look, but he was able to speak to people directly. He brought an informality to TV politics, whether touting his economic plans via infomercial or coming on my show as a private citizen after the election to debate Vice President Al Gore about NAFTA. The audience had never been more informed. When I spoke to him about 6 months ago, he was as curious as ever. I think he would have made an interesting president. He had a lot of deep-rooted American values, though he certainly went his own way. Observance by Larry King on Ross Perot. This item is accompanied by a full-color, half-length shot. Caption says, Perot speaks to the press in June 1992. The Texas billionaire ran for president that year, as well as in 1996. Under Died, Hal Gilberto, Supernova. Observance by Wilder Davies. When Hal Gilberto was 14 years old, his grandfather gave him his first guitar. A year later, he dropped out of school and dedicated his life to music. That singular commitment led Gilberto, who died on July 6th at 88, to become one of Brazil's most iconic artists. Early on, Gilberto forged a sound that replicated the syncopated percussion of samba music on his guitar and paired it with his dulcet vocals. When he began working with composer Antonio Carlos Jobim in 1957, that style became bossa nova, which they exported to the world on the album Chega de Saudade. In 1964, his collaboration with saxophonist Stan Getz on Getz/Gilberto and his track The Girl from Ipanema, featuring vocals by his then-wife, Astrid, earned him Grammys for Album and Record of the Year. And his career in the half-century that followed influenced generations of musicians in Brazil and beyond. At Gilberto's public funeral in Rio de Janeiro, an orchestra and choir performed the title track from Chega de Saudade to a crowd of mourners. Saudade is a Portuguese word that describes painful longing and nostalgia. Chega de means, quote, no more, unquote. The Gilberto profile is accompanied by a half-length black-and-white photograph of Gilberto with his guitar. The date is unknown. Under died Ava Kaur, survivor of experiments on twins at Auschwitz, who later became a Holocaust educator, died on July 4th at 85. Under died Rip Torn, the actor best known for his role on The Larry Sanders Show, died on July 9th at 88. Under banned, banned is spelled B-A-N-N-E-D, niqabs, or full-face veils, niqabs, spelled N-I-Q-A-B-S, niqabs, or full-face veils, banned by Tunisia's Prime Minister, Youssef Rahed, on July 5th, citing security concerns. Under signed, a bill that would allow certain congressional committees to obtain President Donald Trump's state taxes by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on July 8th. Under announced, a run for the presidency by billionaire liberal donor Tom Steyer, spelled S-T-E-Y-E-R, on July 9th. The number of Democrats running held at 24, as Representative Eric Swalwell dropped out the day before. Under apologized, Starbucks on July 7th, after an employee asked police officers at an Arizona store to move or leave when another customer said the police made them feel unsafe. Starbucks apologized on July 7th. Under registered, a 7.1 magnitude earthquake in California on July 5th, one day after a 6.4 quake. They were the area's biggest in 20 years. Under ended, the print edition of the Chicago Defender, a 114-year-old black newspaper, ended on July 10th. The publication will continue online. That was the entire content of the Milestones page. On the Facing page, there is another edition of the feature news ticker, once again consisting of three news items stacked one on top of the other in the left margin this time. Top item, North Korea touts defection. North Korean state media reported on July 6th that the son of the highest profile South Korean defector had followed in his father's footsteps and permanently resettled in the north. Cho In-guk reportedly decided to defect to fulfill his parents' wishes and work for the North's unification with the South. Middle item. Appeals court skeptical on Obamacare. Federal appeals judges question lawyers about whether the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate is constitutional and whether the law can stand without it. During oral arguments on July 9th, in a case that could threaten health coverage for 20 million people if it ends up overturning the law. Bottom item, Congolese warlord convicted. A Congolese warlord known as the Terminator was convicted on July 8th of war crimes and crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court. Bosco Ntaganda, 45, was the military chief of a rebel group from 2002-2003 and was responsible for recruiting child soldiers. also won this page under category Good Question. The headline is, Could Voters with Disabilities Sway Elections in 2020? Article by Abigail Abrams, who writes, American politicians are used to catering their pitches to various demographies, focusing on African-American workers or suburban women. Yet they don't often talk about people with disabilities, even though those who ignore disabled Americans may be missing out on a growing group of voters. 1 in 4 adults in the U.S. has a disability. But obstacles such as inaccessible polling places and a lack of engagement from politicians have kept their turnout numbers low. That started to change last year, according to a July 10th report. Researchers at Rutgers University found that voter turnout among people with disabilities surged by 8.5 percentage points in last year's midterms, reversing a trend of stagnant or decreasing rates. In 2018, which saw historic turnout across the board, more people with disabilities reported voting than Latinos, who saw their votes nearly double. There were almost as many disabled voters as black voters, too, and their support could be up for grabs in 2020. The American Association of People with Disabilities, parenthetically AAPD, launched a campaign called Revved Up. That's Rev Up, two words, all caps. Launched a campaign called Rev Up in 2016 to promote political participation among members of the disability community. Rev Up is spelled all caps, R-E-V, new word, up, U-P. Now it has Rev Up groups in 32 states and holds a National Disability Voter Registration Drive each July. That is capitalized. National Disability Voter Registration. Other efforts like the Crip the Vote hashtag have helped organize people with disabilities to talk about politics and promote topics they care about. This social engagement can be key to empowering people with disabilities, the Rutgers researcher said. It can also help politicians understand the community, according to Alice Wong, a disabled activist and co-creator of Crip the Vote. That's hashtag Crip the Vote. CRIPTHEVOTE. Quote, a lot of people don't recognize the disability community as a community with a culture or a history, unquote, she says. Quote, we're such a heterogeneous community, and disabilities still seen as very individual health problems, unquote. Still, a gap remains. If people with disabilities voted at the same rate as similar people without disabilities, there would have been 2.35 million more voters in 2018. 2,350,000 more voters. Advocates see this as motivation. Quote, even though we are one of the largest marginalized groups in this country, we don't have the clout of other marginalized groups, unquote, says Helena Berger, president and CEO of the AAPD. Berger is spelled B-E-R-G-E-R. Helena Berger. Quote, our vote is being overlooked. Unquote. Being overlooked can lead people to question whether their vote matters. And even when people with disabilities want to vote, they often face barriers. A U.S. Government Accountability Office review of polling places during the 2016 election found such voters would face at least one impediment at 60% of the locations reviewed. 60%. Disability groups are aiming to address these issues ahead of 2020. So far, the presidential candidates are off to a mixed start in outreach to the disability community, but activists hope there's still time to show this is one block worth wooing before the next election. That organization referenced is the American Association of People with Disabilities, also known as all caps AAPD. That was the entire article by Abigail Abrams. And we go now to the regular feature called the Risk Report, where the headline is Greek Election Brings Hope for a Country in Need by Ian Bremmer. In Greece, the mainstream has returned to power and the populists are in retreat. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis promised that the country would, quote, proudly raise its head again, unquote, and Greek voters have given him a robust election victory. The new prime minister has his work cut out for him. The country's outlook has improved following an agonizingly prolonged economic depression that destroyed a quarter of Greece's economy. But more than 30% of its citizens remain trapped in poverty, and unemployment remains at 18%. It's worse for young people. Nearly 40% lack jobs, and the best and brightest continue to leave the country. Lenders have cheered Mitsotakis' victory and the return of his business-friendly New Democracy Party. New Democracy is capitalized. Lenders have cheered Mitsotakis' victory and the exit of the leftist Syriza government it replaces. Mitsotakis says he will renegotiate Greece's commitment to keep an annual budget surplus and to speed privatization of many public services in order to lower taxes and, quote, jumpstart, unquote, economic growth. The election outcome also surely pleases European leaders. The new democracy is much less likely than Syriza to provoke another economic crisis, an emergency the Europeans probably would not handle well now that an immigration crisis has undermined the EU's political consensus and German Chancellor Angela Merkel no longer has the political capital to broker a credible deal. Mitsotakis' victory gives him a strong political mandate. New Democracy won about 40% of the vote, but Greek election law provides a 50-seat bonus in parliament for the political party that finishes in first place. That gives the new prime minister the outright majority he will need to move his agenda forward. In addition, Mitsotakis, the son of former Prime Minister Konstantinos Mitsotakis, is a capable technocrat, a person whose formative experience is as a consultant for McKinsey rather than as a maker of unkeepable promises like his predecessor, outgoing PM Alexis Tsipras. Yet, Mitsotakis will have to deliver fairly quickly if he's to maintain the momentum his victory has given him. Voter turnout was just 57%, one of the lowest rates in decades. It will be many years before Greece can restore genuine normality by fully repaying the $330 billion it has borrowed from the EU and the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, Syriza, which won more than 30% of the vote, has returned to opposition. Free of responsibility for avoiding economic catastrophe, it can again level unfair criticism on those who have now taken up these burdens. Greece may also face a return of the protests that plagued the last New Democracy-led government and inflicted millions of dollars of property damage in Athens. Future governments will probably be more factious than this one. In 2016, the Syriza government abolished the 50-seat bonus that has given Mitsotakis his current parliamentary majority. Parenthetically, the new law did not apply to this election, but will to those that follow. That adds an element of urgency to Mitsotakis' bid to bring change. If he fails, even if he wins the next election, he's more likely to need a coalition partner to form a government, a partner that will make demands that may make it harder to pursue his agenda. For now, Greeks are justly optimistic that things will get better. But they are far from out of the woods, and the Prime Minister will surely find that winning was the easy part. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. That brings us to the cover story. The major section is World, and the title of the cover story is Bibi's Israel. After 13 years in power, Benjamin Netanyahu can claim to have remade Israel in his image. Is that a good thing? Article by Brian Bennett, Dateline Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pacing the stage at a cyber conference in Tel Aviv, and he is not happy. For the past 7 minutes, he's been making the case that his policies have launched a booming tech industry in Israel and enabled the tiny country that once fought for its existence to become a security force around the globe. He's holding his shoulders up and back, a stage tip he got from Sean Connery. His red tie, white shirt, and dark suit mirror a certain American president who has emerged as a massive Netanyahu ally. But there's a problem. Graphics on the giant screen behind him keep popping up at the wrong time. Quote, "Who's dealing with the slides? Get that person out of there," unquote, Netanyahu says with a sweep of an arm. He makes his next point, then orders, quote, "Now show a slide," unquote. Pause. Nothing. Quote, "God, I've never had this happen before. This will require debriefing," unquote. In mid-July, Netanyahu will surpass David Ben-Gurion, the closest thing Israel has to a founding father, to become the longest-serving prime minister in the country's history. Bibi, as he is universally known here, has won 5 elections and cultivated a U.S. president who appears intent on fulfilling Netanyahu's every desire. So why isn't he in a better mood? The unpleasant reality is that Netanyahu approaches the career summit with his personal power arguably at its greatest risk. Prosecutors have threatened indictments on corruption charges. And he has failed to form a government following his most recent election victory in April. Instead of spending the summer handing out ministries to allies, Bibi is preparing for yet another campaign, a September do-over election that will test yet again whether the Israel that has grown to resemble its prime minister, prosperous, powerful, and resilient, yet insecure, still wants him. The centerpiece slide pops up without a hitch. It's a black-and-white photograph showing Israeli commandos in white coveralls standing on the wing of Sabena Flight 571, a jetliner taken over by 4 Palestinian terrorists in 1972. Quote, That's me up there, I think, unquote, Netanyahu says, pointing to the commandos storming the plane disguised as technicians. Quote, that's 50% me because I don't remember if I was on the left wing or on the right wing of this Sabena airline. Anyway, it was hijacked, and the way we stopped the hijacking then was to burst through the doors and do whatever we did, unquote. The team of 16 Israeli commandos, led that day by Netanyahu's eventual political rival, Ehud Barak, rushed the cabin, killing two of the four hijackers and rescuing some 100 passengers and crew. And that brings us to the end of our time for today's episode of Time Magazine. You've been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, hoping you have enjoyed our volume today, and please be sure to listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website. The current address is TriangleReadingService.org. That is TriangleReadingService.org. We will keep you informed of the new address with our name change. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Number again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time. This is Randall Rickman, your reader, and again, thanking you for your company today. And we look forward to you joining us next time for Time Magazine.